Coffee to keep us all going. And the second session is the bit that I titled Be Prepared. And then we'll do some much more practical stuff about how each of us can witness and can talk about our faith in ways that are helpful to those who hear it. So that's the second half of the morning. So that's how we split it. We're going to do a little prayer exercise just to begin. I'm thrilled that in this church, and I know others in the deanery, people have taken up the Archbishop's call to prayer so seriously over this last week. Your prayer room over there is fantastic. We're going to do this little prayer exercise. And I want you just in silence, shut your eyes and think of two or three people that you know, could be friends, family, colleagues, whatever, who don't yet know Jesus. Just bring those two or three people to your mind. They're people that you love and you care for. So ask God now to bless them. And Father, as we go through this morning, I pray you'd help us by your Spirit to keep those people in our minds, that all we do today may be because of your love for them and our love for them, that they may be blessed. Amen. I'll tell you a story about a circus couple. And if you know the part of the deanery, you may have heard this one, because I tell this one around a bit. And they wanted to adopt a child. They had a circus act. And the social workers were a little bit worried that this would be appropriate. So they called them in for a meeting, and they said to the couple, well, first of all, we're a little bit worried about the child's education and how this child might get a good education, because you move around all the time with your circus. And the couple said, well, don't worry, we thought about that. We have employed a full-time tutor who's going to travel with us, who is fluent in a whole range of subjects, including IT and Mandarin. The child will get a good education. So they said, well, we're very happy with that. They said, well, we're a little bit concerned where the child's going to live, again, with this itinerant lifestyle. They said, well, don't worry, we have bought a 50-foot motorhome, and we've converted the back half of it into a purpose-built nursery. Here are the 10x8 glossy photographs that show you what it's like. It's beautiful. And the social workers are very happy. I said, well, our final question is really about the child's health as you travel around with all the animals and that sort of stuff. And they said, don't worry, we're really taking this seriously. We've employed a full-time pediatric nurse who will travel with us and take care of all the child's healthcare needs. And the social worker said, well, it sounds like everything's taken care of. We're very happy. Have you thought about, you know, whether you're like a boy or a girl or what sort of age of child you'd like to adopt? And they said, no, it doesn't really matter what age the child is or if they're a boy or a girl. What matters to us is they fit nicely inside the canon. Now, I tell you that story because if you want the right answer, you have to ask the right question. Okay? And if we ask the wrong questions, we sometimes end up in the wrong places. So this morning is about helping you to face some questions, and I'm hoping you'll come out the back end of it with an understanding of evangelism in 2016 that is developed, that you can interpret what you see around you a bit better. You can think, imagine, and dream of what could be. And the three key questions, well, sorry, I'm working behind my head, so forgive me. I want to say first off that the good news has not changed, okay? God's plan is still to reconcile all things to himself in Jesus. That's still the good news. That's been the same for 2,000 years. But the way we do things has to change. It always has. The Spirit has always shown us new ways of doing things as years have gone by. And that's the bit we're talking about changing, not the good news itself. Okay? So put that marker in, then we can ignore it from here on. The three key questions we're going to look at in this first hour or why don't other people see the world the way you do? Because believe me, they don't. Secondly, who are the people groups that we're not reaching as churches? Because we can look at the ones around us and think that's great, but who is it that we're not engaging with well? And thirdly, what's changed in evangelism? So this first hour will set us up. We'll do the practical stuff in the second bit. So, first question, why don't other people see the world the way you do? Well, the first answer is an obvious one. It's spiritual blindness. 2 Corinthians 4:4, you know, the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers, so they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who's the image of God. That's the key issue, and the only way through that is to pray for people. That's the heart of it, that's the key issue. And what I'm going to do with that is acknowledge it and park it. We'll come to talk more about how we pray for people in the second half. So we park that as an issue. Spiritual blindness is there. The stuff I'm talking about is the other stuff. It's the cultural issues that are secondary and do change all the time and we need to get hold of. So let's have a little think about how lifestyles have changed in recent years. Changing family lifestyles. 30 years ago, the church's workforce was mostly young mums who were at home until their kids were of a certain age, and usually a father went out to work. Occasionally, mother would go out to work and father would be at home. Nowadays, it is very rare for, in most of the UK, for both parents not to have to go out to work once maternity leave is over. That has fundamentally changed the way a large proportion of families function. And how they look at weekends as well. Because weekends is their time with kids. And the idea of their kids coming into church and going off to Sunday school, they think, no, I want my kids with me at the weekend. It's the only time I see them. That, to someone of my generation, is why wouldn't you want somebody to take your kids off your hands for an hour? But that's changing. And that has to change the way we think. We've also reached a point where most of the population, well over half the population, are what we would call unchurched. They've just never connected with anything like this. It's not they've rejected it, it's just not on their radar to even think that we're relevant. And children have also become the centres of families. It's not uncommon for me now to hear young parents say, well, we wouldn't do anything our children don't want to do. Okay? That's a change, that's different. I think it's linked with the work stuff, actually. So that's a change in family. Work-life balance has changed. Working hours are longer than they used to be. You know, the 9 to 5 is dead, isn't it? People are working huge hours. And the biggest change in that is the mobile phone. You know, I used to run chemical plants for a living, and I went home with a bleep on my hip, and I thought that was intrusive because if something bad happened, it went off. Nowadays, most people are walking home with their office in their pocket. With their emails and everything else, and they are never away from work. That is a huge change, and we haven't really caught up with that as churches yet. And Sundays. Sundays have changed. You know, we are not the only people who have a sign outside saying open on Sundays anymore. And if you think through a typical family Sunday, if you've got children, little Johnny's playing rugby or football on Sunday morning. Little Sophie's at a dance class. Lunchtime, around about that area, that's when the weekly shop is done. And families do that. In the evening, they're sitting down together to watch Strictly or whatever is on Sunday night. There is a kind of gap around about Sunday tea time in many family lives. We tend to put our church services on at just the times they can't get to them. So we have to do some thinking about that. How has the way Sundays have changed in our society changed the way we need to engage with people? So, first little chat, just to two or three people around you. You're grown up, so you can work out how to do this. Just make sure you've got people you can talk to. How have Sundays changed during your lifetime? And what are the implications for evangelism? Just 2 minutes, buzz on that. Okay. Let's draw that to a close. I heard a story of a deanery synod in Berkshire not so long back. And this deanery synod was composed of people sort of 70 and above, which is not unusual for rural deanery synods. And apparently they had this big discussion for a while about why people don't come to church anymore and they're getting more and more ranty about it. And then this lady who apparently was 90-ish years a day stood up and said, aren't we being really stupid? We're putting all our stuff on at the time they can't get there. We've got to think about that. Next issue to think about is generational differences. Okay? Now, this is based on some generational theory thinking. This is not biblical teaching, but this stuff will help you understand the people around you so you can apply scriptural principles better, okay? It's a sociological thing, not a psychological thing. What I mean by that is you can use it to look at whole groups. You can't use it to look at individuals. So you can say, you know, people in this age group in general are like this. You can't say Sally behaves that way because. All right? So that's the first caveat. And it's based on the concept that our early years are formative. Now, in personal counseling, we kind of all get that. We know our personal years are very formative to the kind of people we are. But it happens to whole groups as well. What's going on in the world at the place and the time you grew up, it's both place and time, affects how you think. So let's start with what we call the silent generation. They're currently aged about 70 to 90, born 1925 to 1945. That's the bit that doesn't change. This generation grows older. There's a generation above we call the GI generation. Obviously not that many of them left. They're quite similar to the silent generation. Margaret Thatcher, very typical. Sorry, apologies if you're over 90. Well done. Good on you. Why do we call them the silent generation? It is not because they are silent, anything but. It's because when they were children, they were seen and not heard. Okay? And they sometimes have that expectation of children nowadays, because that's what they had to be when they were little. They're more likely to write you a letter than talk to you, actually, if you're a vicar. But anyway. They grew up during the Depression and World War II, including rationing. Now, if that was how you grew up, imagine the profound effect something like the Great Depression and World War II has on how you are and how you think. They value hierarchy and structure and authority and discipline and hard work. They're really opposed to debt. That's a kind of Great Depression hangover, okay? These are the people who still make most of our civic institutions work. There's lots of people in groups, in villages and towns across the country, thinking, who's going to run this when I've gone? They put duty before pleasure. They're dedicated. They value that. Can be very reticent to express emotion. And they're a waste not, want not generation. They have garages, sheds and lofts full of things that might be useful one day. And you either have that or you have tried to clear out a parent's home because that was like that. Okay? Because there wasn't stuff around, so you did keep it. In God, they're looking for a protector. No big surprise there. And so in church, they desire a God who is in control, a place of refuge and stability when everything else is haywire. So sometimes people say this generation struggle with change. They don't. They have seen more change than any generation has ever seen. You know, my grandparents are dead now, but long dead. But my grandfather had a haulage business, which means he owned a horse and cart. He saw men land on the moon. This generation have seen so much change. It's not change they have a problem with. It's when it feels like it's changing this place of refuge and stability that matters so much to them. Have a look at this little video. Just think about what this generation has seen change.
I bought something from you last week, and I'm very disappointed.
Oh, yeah? What's the problem?
Yeah, well, my BlackBerry is not working.
What's the matter? Run out of juice?
No, it's completely frozen.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. I'll tell you what, let's try it on orange.
That's got a few black spots, you see.
Oh, dear, yeah, sorry about that.
Well, anyway, I need to get my BlackBerry working.
Well, it could be an application issue. But where do you store that BlackBerry?
It's on my desktop.
Well, you could try using a mouse to drag the BlackBerry to the trash. Then after you've done that, you might want to launch the BlackBerry from the desktop.
Well, I've already tried that a few times. I mean, all it did was mess up Windows.
Well, it might be worth waiting a couple of weeks. They got the latest blackberries coming in then.
Well, could you give me a date?
Certainly.
Let me put that date in my diary.
Anything else I can help you with?
Yes, yes. I've also got a problem, to be honest, with my apple.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. That is an old apple, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
When did you buy that?
Last week.
Last week? Oh, they brought out two new apples since then. What's the problem with it?
Well, I tried to put my dongle in it, and it won't fit.
Oh, yeah. And how big's your dongle?
Well, I don't know much about these things, but my wife's seen a few dongles in her time. And she says it's a little bit on the small side.
Well, I'm afraid there's not a lot I can do about that. Tell you what, let me try booting it. No, it's crashed. Anything else I can help you with?
Well, funnily enough, yes. My grandson's birthday soon, you see. Now, he's already got an apple and a blackberry. I mean, have you got anything else that you might just like?
Well, we're doing a special offer on these. I mean, I can't make head or tail of them, but the kids seem to like them.
Oh, yeah.
Eggs books. 360.
Okay, a lot of change that generation. Next lot down, the baby boomers. Looking out, a lot of you will fit in this group. This is my lot. Born 1946 through to the 1960s, about mid-60s. So we're currently late 40s to 70. Okay. We grew up post-war, at the beginning of, or the end of the Enlightenment era, really. Big changes when we were growing up, the start of feminism. Rapidly changing roles for women. Very much the backdrop of our childhoods. We value idealism. Optimism, the bigger picture. We can do anything. We heard Kennedy say we're going to put someone on the moon in 10 years, and we did it. Okay? Hard work is valued by this generation. Excellence, achievement. That typical boomer. And behavior tend to love to work and live to work. And we're motivated by vision. If you work for a company with a boomer in charge, you probably have vision days and stuff like that. And vision statements. We expect to be involved in things. So hierarchy, not quite such a big issue as for the generations above us, but we can tend to micromanage a bit. So you're boomers. Now in God, we're looking for a powerful father. Power in Christ. The distortion of that very easily becomes the prosperity theology that sort of sprung up with our generation. And so in church, we tend to think bigger and better. We count numbers. We like our things to be professionally led. What happens at the front has to be really slick and shiny. And we can't imagine why anybody wouldn't want that. Because we want the best for God, don't we? The thing about worldview is you can't imagine why anyone would want to challenge it. We'll come to that in a minute. So that's typical for a boomer. This little video will just, it's a Volkswagen advert from South Africa. It gives you a feel for the life of the boomers so far.
I remember the days of my life. I recall the faces, mostly yours. Magic moments, life was a mystery. There's no place on earth that we'd rather be. Moving up, going through some changes. Storing up the memories. Then you gave me the light of my life. I always gave the best I could give. I remember
Some men in this generation will open up the bonnet of their car and feel desperately sad looking at the black boxes inside. They can no longer explain to their children how it works. Some of you get that? There are things that unite generations. Then we get to Generation X, born late 60s through to 1989. That's one of the fixed dates. That's when the Berlin Wall fell. That changed the world. Okay? So they're currently 26-ish to late 40s. That's my Dawson Youth Advisor. This lot grew up during the Cold War. So an era of great uncertainty, a lot of world crisis. Broken families became really common for Gen X. They hadn't been before. Is that linked to the boomers' desire to put work above everything? I don't know. A very sexually complex society. Whereas before, you could go through doors. Now all the doors are open, and you just wander around. The idea of lifelong employment has gone for this lot. So you don't join a firm and work for life. That's a major change. So they value choice. They're into more instant gratification, and they're very pragmatic. They're incredibly skeptical of institutions, because institutions have let them down time and time again. They work to live instead of live to work. So they put family and friends above it. They thrive on change, and music really important to this generation. So in God, they're more often looking for God as friend, as comforter, as healer. And in church, individual experience matters. And that something is authentic means more to them than if it's professional. So whereas the boomers want it all shiny and slick at the front, Gen X just saying, well, just make it real, will you? So worship for them, usually more intimate. The big corporate event, not so important. They're not bothered if there's 50 people or 500 people in the room. They're bothered that it's authentic. So how do generations see each other? What do X's look like to a boomer like me? Well, in work, they can sometimes seem like they're not dedicated, because they're not doing the stupid hours that I'm doing. Their attitude of pragmatism in a church setting can look like it's light on the... And their dislike of grand vision can look like they're sneering at something a generation before them thought was valuable. They're not, but it can look that way. And in church, one of the things you'll notice is Gen X, as a rule, do not do rotas, okay? And you will have trouble getting Gen X people on your rotas, because rotas come out 3 or 4 months in advance, and they don't know what they're doing next weekend because Facebook hasn't told them yet, okay? So we have to work out new ways of doing that stuff. This little video helped me understand Gen X. It was banned in some jurisdictions. Please don't be offended. It's quite funny. But it will help you understand Gen X. Life is short, play more. Gen X anthem. Okay, whoops, sorry, don't know what that was. Then we get to Gen Y. Who knows who that is? Except it is written on there, don't look. Yeah, thank you, that's Justin Bieber. So Gen X, born after the Berlin Wall fell, 1990, through to about 2008. Okay, so they're 7-ish to mid-20s now. Why are they called Generation Y? Some people say it's because they come after Generation X. In America, this lot are usually called the Millennials. This is why I think they're called Generation Y. Anyway, the label doesn't really matter. Have you ever wanted to do that? Yeah, I have. Okay. This lot, I say, grew up post-Cold War. They don't have heroes anymore. They have celebrities. It's different. They had very protected childhoods. They do not, as a rule, go run and play in the woods like I did. They're very protected in that bubble. They are the technology experts in the family. This is the first generation whose parents and grandparents have come to them and said, how do I do this? All right? That's a massive change. That's never happened before. That children of this age are teaching their parents and grandparents how to do stuff. They value confidence. They're an incredibly entrepreneurial generation. And they actually have quite conservative values on the environment, on ethics. Gen Y are doing less drugs, less alcohol, and having less casual sex than the generation before them. That might surprise you, but it's true. They're still doing an awful lot of all of them, to be honest, but it's less than the generation before them. They're quite conservative in many ways. In God, they're looking for a trusted advisor that they can discuss things with. They're looking for the all-wise God, not the didactic God. All right? So this is the Jesus who talks with people, not the Moses who laid down the commandments. That's what they engage with. So in church, this generation is actually, even those who are not Christians, more open to spiritual discussion than any of the other generations around today. They're just not looking at established church as a place to have that discussion because they don't think we've got anything particular to offer that they can't find somewhere else. They're looking for a confident church with a voice. So when the bishops put out the thing before the last election saying, you know, this is our political statement before you vote, it wasn't party political, it was just, you know, entering into the politics of society, and some older people were saying, what's the church doing messing around with, you know, politics? This generation was saying, well, that's exactly what I expect the church to do. They expect to participate. And the other reason they're called Generation Y is they ask why all the time. Now, the participation thing is absolutely crucial. The biggest mistake my wife and I ever made in church ministry, we had quite a rapidly growing youth thing, and we had a lot of 18 to sort of 21-year-olds hanging around with the 14 to 18s, and it just wasn't appropriate. So we knew we needed to break the older lot off and give them something separate. And so we found a couple who'd host them, and it was the same night, the same time, it wasn't far away. And we said, look, you need to move on. You know, your issues are not the issues of a 14-year-old. This is what we've done for you. You can go to this instead. They went ballistic. Not because we hadn't given them what they wanted, but because we hadn't engaged them in what they wanted. Okay? It took all my wife's pastoral skills to hold them together. Fortunately, we did. And when we talked about what they wanted, guess what? It was exactly what we'd offered them. But we nearly lost a lot of people because we forgot that simple lesson. You have to engage this group. They have to be part of it. They will wander into the managing director's office to have a chat and just think it's normal. Okay? So this lot to a boomer... implications on size. So if you're expecting to participate in something, it tends to need to be smaller. This generation thrive in the massive thing where they can share the experience, a la pop concert weekend. And they thrive in small groups where they get a say. Where they sometimes struggle is in groups the size that a lot of our churches are, where they think they should have a say, but they haven't got one. So small groups become really important. This will help you understand this generation, and I think inspire you.
I am part of a lost generation, and I refuse to believe that I can change the world. I realize this may be a shock, but happiness comes from within is a lie, and money will make me happy. So in 30 years, I'll tell my children they are not the most important thing in my life. My employer will know that I have my priorities straight because work is more important than family. I tell you this, once upon a time, family stayed together, but this will not be true in my era. This is a quick fix society. Experts tell me 30 years from now, I'll be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce. I do not concede that I will live in a country of my own making. In the future, environmental destruction will be the norm. No longer can it be said that my peers and I care about this earth. It will be evident that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It is foolish to presume that there is hope. And all this will come true unless we choose to reverse it. There is hope. It is foolish to presume that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It will be evident that my peers and I care about this earth. No longer can it be said that environmental destruction will be the norm. In the future, I will live in a country of my own making. I do not concede that 30 years from now, I will be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce. Experts tell me this is a quick fix society, but this will not be true in my era. Families stayed together once upon a time. I tell you this, family is more important than work. I have my priorities straight because my employer will know that they are not the most important thing in my life. So in 30 years, I'll tell my children, money will make me happy is a lie, and happiness comes from within. I realize this may be a shock, but I can change the world, and I refuse to believe that I am part of a lost generation.
See that again? Put Lost Generation into YouTube and you can find it. Okay? Incredibly entrepreneurial generation. To a boomer, though, one of the things that happens with Gen Y, and I think it's a social media issue, is that the barriers between work and play have merged. My nephew works for a design company, and they have plastic guns and scooters and all kinds of things around their office. And the work-play barriers have merged. So and work-social life barriers. My wife and I, because we've been leading churches for a long time, had for the first time in 30-odd years to get a mortgage 3 years ago. And so we walked into the Nationwide and we sat down with this very pleasant young man who we thought we were coming in to have a financial discussion with. And he asked us how we were, and we said, very well, thank you. Do you have a nice weekend? Yes, thank you very much. Get on with the stuff, son. And then he said, it was really hot, wasn't it? And we said, yes, it was really hot. He said, my girlfriend and I couldn't wear anything in bed last night. It was so warm. And for him, that's a normal discussion with a person that he's come across. Okay? For me, this is business and pleasure kind of getting muddled up. All right? It's just a generational thing. It's not right or wrong. It's just different. Last generation, this is a lot born after 2008. We'll call them the emerging generation because we don't know yet. All we really can guess about this lot, because they're too young to know, is they're going to grow up as digital natives. Their digital capital will be completely assimilated with their other lives. So their on and their offline lives will be the same thing. So this stuff that older generations say, well, a Facebook friend, that's not a real friend, and all that sort of stuff, just won't mean anything to this lot. The whole thing will merge together. That's kind of all we know so far. But we need to start looking. So what do you do with that kind of stuff? The first thing to remember is that these different generational understandings are different. They're not right and wrong. Your automatic assumption will be that your understandings are the right one. That's okay, that means you're normal. But break out of that and see other people are just different. God has not changed. And when we're saying different generations look at different aspects of God, they're just looking at just that. They're not saying God has changed, but we see different, emphasize different aspects of his nature in different generations. And it can be affected by different temperaments too. So you can't apply it to individuals and say, well, it doesn't fit because Fred's not like that. It does kind of work across whole things. So what do we do with it? How do you use that information in a church? Well, you can use it to help your understanding so you don't misinterpret other people, the way other people do things. My wife and I don't put something on for a bunch of millennials without talking with them first. That sort of understanding can help you engage better. You can go away and think, what would church look like if it were led by people of a different generation? I had a session once this year where I put a bunch of millennials around a table with sandwiches in the middle and said, imagine what church would look like if you were leading it. And it was the most fun I've had all year. But what they came out with was much more radical than you might think. So that's worth posing. So, little break in yourselves, another couple of minutes in your groups. Discuss ways that we might build relationships across generations. If we've got some of these divides, how can we break them down? And what might a truly intergenerational church look like? Just have a think. What I'm hoping to do in this session is to provoke you to think. You're not going to come up with the answers in these short little chats, but you're starting the discussions that I hope you're going to take away and continue to think about and work on. Because they're not easy things, but they're really worth working on. One encouragement to you, if you, like me, are in the second half of your life, young people really are not put off by age. But they are put off by attitude. They love their grandparents, okay? So teenagers in your church will not be put off by you walking up and saying, hey, how are the exams going? And taking a care and an interest. And one of the key things that we commend in youth work nowadays is to say, if by the age of, say, 16, 17, every young person in this church has 5 significant relationships with adults who are not the youth workers, then the chances are we can hold this group in. You know, it's as simple as that. It's not big and fancy and shiny. It's just having the guts to walk up to one of these scary hormonal things and say, how's it going? Because I care. All right? So you can do stuff to break down generational barriers, especially if you understand them a little bit. If you want to explore this a little bit further, some resources for you there. There's a guy called Graham Codrington, who used to be a youth minister. He now runs a consultancy. And his book, Mind the Gap, is well worth a read. There's some online training on it that puts out for churches a 6-week small group course just on this stuff. And if you can put a group together with a bunch of different generations in it, that's brilliant. Because then you all say what you think and you learn from each other. And there's a couple of other books there. Now, I'm not giving you any notes for this session, but I know some of you are going to come up afterwards and say, please, can I have that list of things from the different generations? So Penny's run a few off for me. It's only the slides about those generations and the bits of those books and where they come from. So if you need those, we've got a few afterwards. Right, second question. Who are the people groups we're not reaching? I'm just going to run a few of these past you fairly quickly. Let's look at the demographics. This graph here shows up the left-hand side percentage of the population, and across the bottom, the year people were born, 1900 through to 1985. It comes from British Social Attitude Survey 2007. The blue bit at the bottom is those people who say, I'm part of the Church of England. Now, some of that, yes, some of them will be ticking the box that they tick in hospitals to say C of E, and it's a bit nominal, but they're saying it for a reason. There's something real there. And you can see we go from 50% down to 5% and falling. All right? So we have to reach younger generations much more effectively than we have been. Now, we're pretty sure that something exciting is happening with our 20-somethings at the moment. There are more 20-somethings, or as a proportion of the population, saying that they're Christian than there are 30-somethings and 40-somethings. Something seems to be turning, but they're not engaging, by and large, with our traditional denominations, like the Church of England. So God's doing something that we need to catch up with, okay? But engaging with younger generations is crucial. The orange bit at the top, the other one I want to show you, is those people who say, I have no religion. Doesn't mean they don't have a spirituality, they say they have no religion. And they have never been in somewhere like this. As I said at the start, they've not rejected us, they just never thought we were on their radar. So we have to get much better at engaging with that group than we have been historically. So that's part of the groups we're not reaching. We've got some gender differences. Yeah, God created us male and female. And our culture is failing to reach men as effectively as we are women. So in the UK on average, there are 7 women in church for every 5 men. Okay? In some churches I work with, it's 2-1. I don't know what your ratio here is in your churches. But there's something about, you know, the gospel is just as relevant to men as it is for women. And there's something about a church which bizarrely has been led by men for centuries that is incredibly feminine in the way we do our decision-making and our challenging and all that kind of stuff. And we need to think about that. So just, again, a very short little buzz. What do men struggle with in church life, in your opinion? And what sort of culture do men value? 90 seconds, that's all I'm going to give you. And if you're a bloke and you feel strongly, you start. Okay, I just want to try a quick straw poll on this one. In any of those discussions, was worship mentioned? Yeah? Something like, blokes find it easier to sing God is great than Jesus, I love you. All right? Both statements are true. And both need to be part of our worship. But that kind of thing can be important. Men respond better to really upfront challenge. The most evangelistic question I know to ask a man is, can you help me? Because blokes like to do stuff, all right? And we just need to get our heads around that. And our decision-making sometimes is just so airy-fairy. And that's a bloke speaking, all right? And I can put a woman's point of view on that and say, no, we're engaging well and we're getting everybody involved. And we've just got to balance this up a bit, because right now the stats are really clear. We've not got a balance in our churches. We're not engaging men well enough. The CVM. One thing, I don't know if you engage with it, there's an organization called Christian Vision for Men, and they have a thing. They call it, a bunch of blokes meet in a field near Swindon. That's how they advertise it. And it's a sort of spring harvest stroke new wine thing for blokes and blokes only. And that can be an interesting thing to take a little group away with and try it. That's one place to dip your toes in. Personality types. Who would have thought that we reach some sorts of personality types and not others? But let me give you some stats. We are all built differently. We know that. Professor Leslie Francis, who's done most of the work on this, he has a statement, all types are called, but some are more likely to respond than others. And again, it's not an issue with God's message, which is for all people. It's how we put it over. Now, the problem with personality type stuff is it's unseen. You can't look at someone and say, you can look at people and say they're male, female, they're this age, that age. Personality type's hidden. And for those of you who are not into this sort of stuff, I'd just give you a quick idea of how it works. It's where do you get your source of energy? There are introverts that get it from within. It doesn't mean they're quiet. I'm an introvert. It means when I've mixed in a room with loads of people and had a great time, I need to go and lie down for an hour and recover. Okay? That's what introverts do. Extroverts go in the room with 30 people and think, oh, wow, I feel really energized afterwards. Okay? Gathering data. Sensing types pull the facts in. Intuitive types look at theories and the bigger sort of what's behind it. So if you're revising, your sensing types, will learn it. Your intuitive types will just get the idea of how it works. Evaluating data, your thinking types like logic, your feeling types more interpersonal. And that's the only one that's got a real big gender bias to it. 70% of women are F, 70% of men are T. Okay. Approach to the outer world. The judging types like organization, we want it all sorted out. The perceiving types like flexibility. So you're trying to get a decision out of a P, good luck. Okay? That's the way those two work. Now, just a couple of things to make you think. Those with an SJ temperament are 44% of the population and 72% of the Church of England. SJ, that's the sensing and judging. They're basically, if you put them together, they're the guardians of tradition, the SJs, okay? And it doesn't matter what they are. What I'm trying to show you is there are certain personality types that we engage with well and certain that we don't. I mean, that's a staggering statistic. 44% of the population and 72% of the Church of England. So we're not engaging across all profiles. This one's just a bit fun, really. There's a whole load of Bible characters who somebody has assigned Myers-Briggs personality types to, all right? If you're a Mary type, an ISFJ, you love the Church of England, okay? This grouping in general is okay. That lot, the Esthers, the clever, they don't walk in through our doors very much at all. And that whole grouping really struggle with us, as they do. So we're biased. Now, at some level, these things change with different denominations. So if I do this survey with New Frontiers, you get a different sort of grouping. And so we can say, under the economy of God, denominations at one level are a little mess up because we've said, Jesus, you're in charge of the church, and there's only, one of it, but by the way, we split it up for you. Another level, we can say denominations have helped us spread this. But we can still get smarter about how we do it. One of the ways we can get smarter is by looking at new ways of doing church. Fresh expressions of church is the term we tend to give it at the moment. And it means what you do with a fresh expression is instead of saying, we're going to do this, I wonder who'll come, we're saying, here's a group, how do we engage with them? And by and large, fresh expressions are pulling in more extroverts, more intuitive types, more perceiving types. So we're balancing things up. So the message for us is, you can't get too technical about, well, will this suit an SJ or whatever? I'm not bothered about that. What I'm trying to get out there is we need more variety. And we need to do lots of things differently because it will engage with different people. I'm going to skip through this one. No, I'm not. Really quickly, in little groups of 3 and 4, share something in 10, 15 seconds about how you connect best with God. And then just see if you're all the same. Okay, just turn to each other. How do you best connect with God? Give you an idea. I do it best sitting in a room on my own with the Bible in front of me. How do you do it? Okay, so I'm going to rush you through that one. Did we hear enough to hear that we're kind of different? Or are we sitting by people that are like us? Did we get different answers? Yeah, we did. Okay. And we're a pretty homogenous group. Imagine if we actually represented the whole population, how different those things would be. So let's think on that and be creative and imaginative about how we engage. Couple of bits about how we're seen by the population. This might surprise you. Big piece of research commissioned by the Church of England and lots of other denominations and Hope recently, but run by Comres as a professional survey, looked at what do the population at large think of Christians. Okay? So you bite your nails at this point. If you want to see it, go on a website called talkingjesus.org. It's all there. The summary is this. Jesus good, Christians okay, church bad. All right? That's your summary. Okay? But beliefs about Jesus. This is the English population as a whole, including the Christians. And about 9% of England are practicing Christians, and defining that as go to church maybe at least once a month, pray a bit, read the Bible a bit. Okay? That's your 9%. Jesus was a real person who actually lived. 60% of people believe that. Now you'd say 40% don't, but actually I can work with the 60. He was a mythical character, 21%. Now, a slight struggle with facts of history there, but that's what people think. That they think Jesus was God in human form, 21% would say yes to that. A spiritual leader or prophet, 30%, a normal human, 17%. That's the population we're working with. Okay? It's important we know that. 49% say faith adds meaning to life. That's good. We can work off that. Now, this is the killer stat. This is brilliant. 67% of the English population personally know a follower of Jesus. A lot of that's family, a lot of it's friends. 67%. If you work for a company and you had that kind of coverage, you'd think that was fantastic. That means that without putting on a single event, a single organized thing, 2/3 of the UK population can hear about Jesus. That's amazing. And that's why we're doing the bit after coffee. Okay? That's really important and amazing. Now, what do they think of us? This really surprised me. This is just non-Christians. What do they think about Christians? 65% think we're friendly. Half of them think we're caring. Nearly half of them think we're good-humoured. Now, this is surprising me. 13% thought we were narrow-minded, 10% hypocritical, 7% homophobic. Those numbers are a lot lower than I thought they'd be. But this was a really good piece of research. When they did it the first time, they used a sample of 3,000 people, and which is apparently what these surveys normally run on. And the church leader said, "No, we don't believe this, go away," and do it again. And they did it on 10,000 people, which in market research terms is, you know, really big. Came out with the same numbers. Okay? So we can have some trust in that. Just have a think to yourself. Anything surprise you in that? Anything encourage you? I've given you lots of hints already. But what in that can change the way you think? Maybe you don't have to be as defensive as you thought. So, final question. Sorry, I'm not going to give you time to talk about that. You can do that over coffee, because I am going to give you time for coffee. The third question today was, this first session, what's changed in evangelism? Okay? Surely it's just the same, we're giving the message out. Well, let me just try and help you down that road a bit. In the 1980s, we were doing our evangelism in stadiums. Mission England, 1984, I was there. Because we could advertise events like that and people would come. Billy Graham's coming. Oh, I want to hear Billy Graham. He might have something good to say. By the 90s, we were doing guest services. Church I was in then, you put guest service on, you get 300-400 people along. And they were still at the point where people would come to hear what the church had to say. By the 2000s, that was the heyday of small group evangelism. Alpha was at its height. Now, I'm not saying things like that are not important now. I think small group are still really important. But they will get smaller and smaller if we don't do the next bit. Because people are, the attractional model isn't going to work so well. People aren't going to come just because we put things on. Now, most of the evangelism I do is one-to-one. Down the pub or in some space like that. Now, the process of evangelism at one level hasn't changed. But what has changed is where people are beginning. Okay. We'll go through this again in the next session as well. But there's a thing called the Engel scale. It's a very simple way of looking at people's spiritual development. Okay, invented by a guy called James Engel in the 50s. And it starts with people at minus 10 with no God framework at all. All right, poor old Richard Dawkins stuck at minus 10, bless him. Okay, then you experience emptiness, vague awareness of Christianity, and it goes on. Positive attitudes, awareness of personal need, you grasp the implications, challenge to respond. It's all those kind of pre-Christian steps. It's a long journey. Then you get the point at zero that we classically call conversion, repentance and faith. But that's not the end of it. We keep growing. You evaluate the decision. You learn the basics. You become a functioning member of a church. You grow in character and lifestyle. And then you get to the point of effective sharing life and faith, and it keeps going. You know, if you think you've arrived as a Christian, you're in deep trouble. We're always growing and hopefully getting closer to Christ. Now, with that as a sort of scale, don't worry about the individual bits, but the whole idea that it's a whole long process, all right? Now, we put that scale on its side. Richard Dawkins on the left, Justin Welby on the right. Typically, we've done our outreach around about there. Okay? And we do church about there. So that's all right. Where we do our outreach grabs a bunch of people who could easily move into church. Problem we've got is that most of the people we're trying to reach are now there. You know, they've not been Christianized by society. They're not being sent to Sunday school when they were little, even though their parents weren't Christians, like I was. They just have no background. And you say, well, you know, we do this wonderful outreach with our toddlers. Why aren't they coming to church? You look at it like that, and it's a bit obvious. Okay? There's this huge gap, and we need to put the steps in. We need to fill the gap so people can walk along. Now, if you've got a really good culture of invitation in your church that doesn't say, will you go to this, but says, hey, I'm coming, I'm going, would you like to come with me? Then you can often bridge that gap, all right? That, to me, is Holy Trinity Brompton's secret. The secret is not Alpha. Alpha could have been anything. Christianity Explored, all these things work just as well. What HTB are brilliant at is they've got this culture of invitation where people in their church expect to bring other people along. All right? But most of us are not brilliant at that. And there's another axis on this scale now, that most of the stuff we've got developed for helping people grow is essentially didactic. It essentially says, we have some truth, we'd like to tell you what it is. We've got people out there now who are saying, look, I'm happy to engage in a spiritual discussion with you, but not on the basis that you know it and I don't. And I'll engage in a conversation. All right? So most of the people we're trying to reach are actually there. Okay? And yes, they want to engage with spiritual stuff, but they feel they've got as much to say as you have. And you engage much more conversationally. And that is not the way historically that we've done our evangelism in the last, you know, 100 years, couple hundred years in this country. And that would be my definition of evangelism for you. An invitation to a life of discipleship. As an evangelist, I used to set the bar quite low, because it was nice to get a notch on your Bible and get somebody to pray that prayer, and then they were in. And I saw too many stillbirths. All right? I set the bar much, much higher now. And I make people count the cost a lot more before I help them jump in. All right? It's this invitation to a whole life of discipleship. One last little bit, just going through the fresh expressions of church thing a bit more. One of the things we know is that growing churches are likely to understand their context, understand the 90% of people that aren't there, and engage with non-church goers in effective ways. And this is a Justin Welby quote. So often we want to fit people who are not Christians into our church, not make church fit for non-Christians. And the whole Fresh Expressions of Church movement is about saying, how do we help this group of people engage? And so we've got these models that historically we've worked with, an attractional model that says, come to us, you'll enjoy it. Sometimes we use the engage model, where we'll go out and maybe we'll do some litter picking, or we'll cut some grass, we'll do something in the community and say, hey, would you want to come back with us? All right? It's not wrong. It's just, you know, one of the things that we'll do. The Fresh Expressions model works on the, you go out and you stay out. And you work with people and you let discipleship emerge in that new setting. And that's a whole new morning to talk about Fresh Expressions of Church, but you see the mindset change. Start with church and the mission will probably get lost. Start with the mission and it's likely that the church will be found. Okay. Just to give you a feel in this diocese, at the moment, 16% of the people that worship in this diocese worship in things that we define as Fresh Expressions of Church. These are not things that might happen one day. God is doing this stuff already, all over the place. And I'm about to employ somebody to be an advisor in the diocese to help us get up to speed. We think it's that important. It's part of our strategic plan. Of the 1,009 people, we had this all surveyed by the Church Army 2 years ago. Big, massive piece of research. We send 1,000 people out, roughly, to start these Fresh Expressions that we've got. And in 3 years, that had turned into 4.5 people, or 4 and a bit people. We got 310% return on those. We are not seeing growth like that anywhere else in the church. And the 54% of them were lay-led, as a message. And almost half of those new people were the unchurched grouping. Nothing else we're doing is hitting that grouping that way. All right? They're really important for the future. So that's the end of the first session.